Hi, welcome to Cult Following. I'm Dr. Katie, and with me is my co-host, Todd Fisher.
Hi, Dr. Katie.
Hi, so before we jump in, I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I am a doctor in clinical psychology.
And I'm an expert in comparative religious study. What a team we make, right?
Yes, I think it'll make a great team.
I've researched over 4,000 religions, spiritualities, mythologies, and philosophies. So this kind of merged this podcast together. And in this introductory episode, we're going to kind of go over a little bit about why we like cults and why we want to do this podcast. So why don't you explain what our introductory episode's like?
So in our introductory episode, we're really just going to discuss our approach to talking about cults in our own unique way through the historical perspective of how the cults formed and how they've ended. And then in some cases, through interviews with the people that were part of them. But for this episode, we're really going to be focusing on the way that we are talking about cults in general and just kind of giving some background about cults and cult leaders, defining cults, and also talking a little bit about just kind of laying the groundwork for people that join cults as well, or how we have viewed that in the research that we've both done.
Yeah, for sure. And where I bring a kind of an inquisitive fascination of the doctrines behind cults, Dr. Katie will explore the psychology behind those enigmatic leaders of the cults and the reasons behind why people would follow them. So I think it's really an interesting combination. I kind of have a fascination with doctrines like this, and she has a fascination with the people that are part of them. And really, I think in life generally, we're kind of indoctrinated into so much anyways. I think that's really interesting. You know, I won't say that like everyday life is a cult, but you do kind of, you know, grow up in a certain income level, a certain education level. You know, everyone's kind of indoctrinated into something. The neighborhood you grew up in, the education level that you wind up getting, whether you're Republican or Democrat, like all these things you're kind of indoctrinated into based on the people you're around. And in these cases, these are very extreme cases of how cults develop. And I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of America's fascination with cults today. To me, it seems like cults are more popular than ever in pop culture. So I did a little research. So I'm going to read from my list here. But so right now, currently, HBO has the Heaven's Gate Cult of Cults 4-part documentary series, The Vow, which was about the NXIVM cult, which you and I, Katie, were watching and talking about. That's how this whole thing evolved, was watching that miniseries and then having a lot of late night conversations talking about what we thought of that episode. Like,
yes.
And the NXIVM cult, which The Vow is about, was actually like an executive success program, not even a spiritual type cult, which was interesting. But also made in just the last few years, there was Truth and Lies, which was the Jonestown Paradise Lost, which was a documentary. Truth and Lies, the Waco documentary, which was the Branch Davidians. A&E did their documentary series on cults and extreme beliefs, which I think was like a 10 or a 12 part series. Leah Remini, of course, has her Scientology in the Aftermath, which was a couple seasons of a television show as well as a popular podcast. Mm-hmm. Then there was a Waco movie that starred Taylor Kitsch as David Koresh. So I think he was in Friday Night Lights, right? So they got that guy to be David Koresh. And then there was a Hulu original series called The Path that starred Aaron Paul, which was like a combination of a lot of different new religious movements and spiritualities and things like that. That was actually a really good show. I watched that one. And there are many, many news stories and exposés and podcasts devoted to cults. It's like there's cult mania going on right now. So what do you think, Dr. Katie, the public's fascination is with cults, with this, all this pop culture and all this stuff in general?
Yeah, I like that you just listed all of those, and I'm sure there are even more, but I guess I kind of think about it as my fascination with it is similar to my fascination with like true crime. And I think probably similar for other people, like on some level, we really like to look at these niche subcultures that exist in the world and the United States. And it's, I mean, I hate to say this, but in a lot of ways, I think people kind of like to watch a train wreck happen and see, you know, where, how did this start and how did these people get involved in this? And I think we can sit at home while we watch these shows and maybe, you know, even listen to this podcast and think, oh man, I would never get involved in that. But as we'll see, when we talk about each cult individually moving forward, you know, some of these, like you were talking about the Nixium cult, don't even necessarily start out as something that seems like it would be a cult. It's almost like something that could advance your career or a new psychological movement or something that could help your mental health or provide support. So I'm thinking the public's fascination is just, like I said, really being interested in these kind of niche subcultures that exist that we don't always see until they come to the forefront once everything's kind of fallen apart and that train wreck has happened. What are your thoughts, Todd?
Well, I think you're right on the money with all that. You know, certainly witnessing the train wreck is something, is a reason why, because a lot, in most cases, these shows were made, these documentaries were made because these things have already ended, and they ended tragically in some way. Jonestown, everyone was, you know, was basically murdered, told to drink, you know, the poison Kool-Aid. And in Nexium, it becomes a place for sex trafficking in modern day slavery. And it's a sex cult in a way. And so all of these had really weird things. The Branch Davidians, the Waco compound there, that was something where the ATF and the FBI came in and they burned the place to the ground. Like, it's still unclear to this day who was really at fault in that. And whether the federal government had something to do with the deaths of all those people. So there's a lot of things that are mysteries. And these are all things we're covering this season that I'm touching on.
I was going to just jump in real quick and say, too, I'm really looking forward to, because you're already starting to kind of touch on this. There's a lot of philosophical things that go into these ideas behind these cults. And even when we analyze them now, and I'm really just looking forward to taking a deeper dive as we move forward with the podcast into all these aspects of cults that maybe you don't get in some of the shows that we just talked about.
Yeah. And to answer your question, actually, the other thing too, I think is, I think people have like a real fascination with the secret club, you know? People join.
Yeah, yes.
I still bug my friends about, what was your fraternity secret handshake? You know, like, what was it? Tell me. And they're like, I won't tell, you know? And then there's, and then you know, for a long time, and more our parents' generation more than anything, but there were always clubs. You could join the Masons, you could join the Knights of Columbus, you could join these organizations that had their secret meetings, and, you know, who knows what these were. And there's a lot of like legend and really interesting, you know, mythologies surrounding some of these groups, people saying the Masons were part of the foundation of the country and that they go back to like the Knights Templar and all this stuff, like way back in early Christianity, is really fascinating. You know, maybe this is nothing. Maybe they just meet on Thursday nights and have drinks and eat, you know, and that's it. It's a boys club, like whatever. Mm-hmm. But there's still a lot of interest in these secret club type things. And I think that's interesting. And I think people have a fascination for that. I mean, who doesn't want to be in a secret club, right?
Right. I agree.
There's Facebook groups I can't join. They won't let me into. And I'm like, why won't you let me in? You know?
We won't talk about that on the podcast for legal reasons.
No. Yeah, right.
Only kidding.
So I think there's a whole lot of things, the true crime aspect of it, the secret club aspect of it, watching the train wreck unfold aspect of it. Maybe people that are confused about their spiritualities, you know, who knows? I think that's a lot of people that join these things anyways. What I want to do, I do want to get into though, is I want to kind of take some of my knowledge and inform the listeners a little bit about kind of how some of these start to happen. And we're going to get into what cults are and what cult means, but I want to go back just kind of the precursor to that. And that's the new religious movement. The new religious movement is really kind of the cornerstone of, if cults form, they generally form from this. Not all new religious movements become cults, and not all new religious movements are bad, but I want to explain to the listener what that is. So the term new religious movement refers to religions which have appeared since the mid-1800s. So they're relatively modern in origin. So they can be new religious movements, may be new in origin, or they may exist on the fringes of a wider religion. So they may be sects of Christianity, for instance. They're usually distinct from their pre-existing denominations, but may still be on the fringe of that denomination. So it's interesting how they function and how they appear. And they usually appear in small pockets. And what I want to get into with this is there are usually some new rules and some new doctrines, but the lines can really be blurred when deciding what makes a new religious movement. So you're still following the New Testament, or you're still following some other doctrine, but there may be things added to it. And that's where it gets a little tricky to decide. So let's talk about it a little more. So new religious movements are generally seen as employing human and material assets to spread their ideas and worldviews. And what this means is they might have books available, they might hand out pamphlets, they may have meetups or retreats, and sometimes it's as simple as knocking on a door and delivering a testimonial, which I think everyone's had someone knock on their door at one time and want to deliver a religious message. So a new religious movement often demands a considerable amount of time and amount of group conformity and social identity that separates their people from mainstream society. And this is by means of a hairstyle or a clothing style. Sometimes it happens with a secret handshake, like I talked about before. Many groups might be self-labeled as Christian organizations or charities. Some are considered self-help groups. Some are veiled as drug and alcohol addiction STEP programs. So a lot of STEP programs have religion as an involvement in it. Some are even disguised as executive success programs like NXIVM was. Some people are even introduced into questionable philosophical and spiritual practices from things as simple as yoga classes. So it's out there. This stuff is out there. And I think everyone listening has probably had an experience or seen this in some way in their own life. The religious scholars have estimated that new religious movements now number in the tens of thousands worldwide. And most are in Asia and Africa. Most have only a few members. Some have thousands, and a few have more than a million. Many, but not all of them, have been considered to be cults. Now, everything I've said here isn't meant to imply that these groups are evil in nature. Should very much specify that. Not all of them are evil in nature, but they can often be a precursor to something bad. And sometimes there's some great wisdom or practice or prophecy from a great thinker that shows up from time to time. And that's what I'm really interested in. We can't underestimate that happening. I kind of like those new spiritual thinkers that are out there. I like to see what they write, what they talk about, and how they kind of bring something new. And that's my interest in this. But the question becomes how that new thought leader delivers their message and how they interact with their practitioners or their followers.
Yeah. So Todd, how does a new religious movement then become a cult?
Okay. Good question. So the term cult usually refers to that social group defined by its religious, spiritual, or philosophical beliefs, or its common interest in a particular personality or object or goal. The term itself is even cult. The cult term is actually controversial, and it has divergent definitions in both pop culture and academia. And it's also been an ongoing source of contention among scholars across several fields of study. So I think maybe what we should do is go into kind of the categories of cults, and then it'll be easier to answer your question.
Okay. Yeah. So are there categories of cults? What would you say those are?
There are many subcategories of cults. So some of these are going to be, and I'm going to kind of talk a little bit more detail about these cults as we go along, but there are doomsday cults, there are personality cults, there are political cults, there are destructive cults, there are racist cults, there are polygamous cults, and there's terrorist cults. But what makes a cult varies from country to country, and even defined differently among government types. So it's really interesting that what Germany might call a cult, America embraces. So it's really odd dynamic, right, of things. For instance, Scientology is embraced in America. People criticize it, they talk about it, but in Germany, it's illegal. You can be jailed for being a Scientologist in Germany. So it's an entirely different way of thinking with all of this. Even religious organizations will classify cults differently. So what Christians might think of one, what Hindus might think of one, are all different and conflicting. So it's very interesting.
So there's a big cultural aspect to this clearly as well.
Yeah. People look at it differently all over the world. So this is not an easy way to define cults. And honestly, I think the term cult is used too loosely these days. I think a lot of things get labeled with this four-letter word that shouldn't be. And it's unfortunate because once you kind of have that label put on you, it's hard to come back from that, you know? I know, and I don't want to get too far off the subject, but I will say real quickly, with Nexium, what I think is interesting is that even though the people that needed to be brought to justice have been, you know, leadership's out, there's still intellectual property content that Nexium made, which is still actually interesting and good doctrine. And it's funny because that stuff could be used somewhere. They even have patents on some of their technology that they created. So the wonder is, okay, you remove all the bad people. Can you still teach it? Well, we've removed Catholic priests that had problems in the Catholic Church for molesting people or being homosexual, whatever it was that happened there. They're gone, but the Catholic Church didn't go away. They could take away thousands of priests. The Catholic Church is still functioning. So could the core of the Nexium programming still function today? Or does the public just think, oh, that was cult stuff. We can't go near that now. Even though they might have actually had some real good stuff that helped people in an executive success program before everyone started sleeping with everyone, you know?
Yeah, it is so, very interesting.
But I wanted to mention, so let's talk about the Christian cults first, because I think a lot of these cults have evolved over time out of religion. So I'm going to talk about the signs of what a Christian cult might be. So a Christian cult will add to the word of God. It's never just the Bible alone as authority. They subtract from the deity of Jesus. So they'll say he's a prophet. They'll say he's a teacher. They'll say he's the devil's brother, but they'll never say it's God in the flesh. There will always be some other way to put off what Jesus really is. So you have to join them. You have to be baptized. You have to go door to door. You have to obey the commandments. No one is saved by grace through the faith in Jesus Christ alone. Like there's very specific things that will happen in certain Christian cults. They'll divide your loyalties. You're deceived into placing your primary loyalty toward the cult and its leader instead of in Jesus. They pressure members to confess their past sins. They can make those confessions public. They can use them against their members. They can blackmail their members. They'll keep files on their members. They'll do a lot of things like that, really devious tactics to keep you in their church. You're also discouraged from associating with non-members of the cult and forbidden to have anything to do with ex-members. So you're kind of, if you're an expatriate of it, you can't be part of it anymore. And true Christians are encouraged to maintain contact and closeness with people, but cults tend to want to divide people. And that's one of the biggest differences there.
Yeah, we start to see that isolation come into play really strongly there.
Yeah. And let's talk about some of the other cults too. I want to talk about, this is, I think, one of the biggest ones here, the destructive cult. So this is one of the most common ones that makes the news stories and pop culture. And generally, a destructive cult refers to a group whose members have, through deliberate action, physically injured, mentally abused, or even killed other members of their own group or other people. A destructive cult is a highly manipulative group which exploits and sometimes physically and or psychologically damages members and recruits. And this is kind of the most common type of cult that we know and that we'll be talking about this season.
Yeah, so destructive cultism is really a sociopathic syndrome. And we'll talk a little bit more about sociopathy and psychopathy and some other psychological disorders and terms that come into play with cults as we go forward. But those distinctive qualities in this destructive cultism often include behavioral and personality changes, loss of personal identity, cessation of scholastic activities, estrangement from family, disinterest in society, and pronounced mental control, and enslavement by cult leaders even. And this is in part due to the abundance of adulation given to these charismatic leaders of these destructive cults. And so this contributes to the leaders becoming even more corrupted by this power, right? It kind of becomes this cycle. And the most common accusation made against destructive cults is sexual abuse.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That is probably the biggest type of cult that we see evolve today. And I think one of the, probably the second the most important type of cult that we've seen covered in the news or in pop culture has been the doomsday cults. And so a doomsday cult is an expression which is used to describe groups that believe in an impending apocalypse. And it can also be used to refer both to groups that predict disaster and to groups that attempt to bring it about. In the late 1980s, doomsday cults were a major topic of news reports, with some reporters and commentators considering them to be a serious threat to society. People turned to this cataclysmic worldview that existed in the 80s after they had repeatedly failed to find meaning in mainstream movements. So people were beginning to lose faith. I grew up in the 80s and I remember what it was like to on the news every night, literally every night. It was, we're a day closer to full-scale nuclear war. Like our world we lived in then was, it was the US and the Russians, and it was, we hated each other. And it was every day, it was drummed into your head that, look, we're all going to launch missiles and everything's going to be destroyed. Mutually assured destruction, they called it. And it was terrifying. So I'm, you know, an eighth grader living in this world, and even all the movies and the entertainment, it was always apocalyptic. It was always about nuclear war. And it's crazy. And even today, I don't want to get off the subject too much. I talk about this in my book, but you know, there are so many nuclear weapons on this planet. They're probably, I think, the single biggest danger to this planet more than anything, more than global warming is. And the stuff you hear on the news every day, more than COVID, this is way worse. One atomic bomb is all the COVID deaths we've already had in a year. Like these are terrible things to have on the planet. So when you take a 10-year span of time in pop culture and in the news cycle to see this drummed into your head, it psychologically messes with you, and you don't get answers from the church when you go there. They don't, priests don't want to talk about the apocalypse. It's not one of their they don't want to bring up revelations. It's not a happy Sunday conversation. So people navigated over to doomsday cults. Some were UFO cults. People thought UFOs would come down, pick you up, take you off the planet. And many were just about what was going to happen. You know, Halley's Comet was going to come. People thought Halley's Comet would crash into the planet, or we would go through the tail of Halley's Comet. Everyone would turn into zombies. Like it was always this crazy stuff.
And maybe something that wasn't as intense, but the Y2K,
the frenzy of that
fear. In 2000, and I remember that, you know, waiting on New Year's Eve, and people were really concerned that something might happen that would, you know, create kind of an apocalyptic scenario. And I think you're really also touching a lot on the anxiety that these things drum up, and then people are really searching for answers that they may not be able to find with the supports or the, you know, religious movements that they're already involved in. And so maybe this is where they sometimes start to look elsewhere.
Yeah, for sure. Y2K is a good example. You know, everyone thought all the computers would shut down, all your money would be gone. Like everyone was taking all their money out of the banks. Like it was crazy. But you know, this doomsday cult thing actually goes back a lot further. Like this stuff goes back to the Mayans. The Mayans had an end calendar date. A lot of prophets, the Nostradamus prophecies, lots of this stuff. There were lots of, you know, doomsday fanatics out there. And, you know, we don't know what happened to the Mayans. They seemingly vanished overnight. So maybe they were part. Maybe they all killed themselves.
maybe they did get picked up by aliens. We don't really know.
It's crazy. So this kind of thing has been around for a long time. But naturally, when you live, you know, in the 21st century, when you have everything available at your fingertips, it's much easier to have this type of thing, you know, be out there. Now, where we're at today with doomsday cults, we're going to research that and find out if there's doomsday cults out there. Are there groups out there now that believe the end's coming and they're going to do themselves in before it happens? Are there doomsday cults that are trying to bring it about? It's $20 million question out there. It's really interesting. And I'll just touch on this before we move on to the next couple of cults, but it's really interesting. So there are Christian cults that are doomsday cults. And here's the interesting fascination about it. all Christians really want is to be reunited with their Savior. That's what they want. They want the end days to come because that's when they're truly going to be free of this life cycle that they're in. There's a lot of people that have that's their belief. You know, a lot of people look at religion in a lot of different ways and what they want to get out of it. But the ultimate goal is to be reunited with Jesus and to do it in heaven. That's what they want. So a lot of Christians want the end days to come. They look forward to it because they know they're going to be that much closer to getting to their Savior. It's a really interesting thought, but there's a lot of groups that actually participate in thinking about this. They welcome the end because they know that's going to be their final freedom, their final salvation to all of this. So it makes me wonder if there's 51% of the world are Christians, right? What does that mean when you're in a position of power? Are these people cogs in a machine where they can start to make this stuff actually start to happen? Are people in places where they can deny certain things or approve certain things to actually move this forward so it does happen? Because if you are thinking about this in a religious way and this is what you want, why wouldn't your goals be to bring it about? So I think it's really interesting to think about kind of that view. And a lot of people don't look at it as the, you know, there's a cup is half full, cup is half empty point of view to religion in a lot of ways. But there's a lot of people that definitely believe that. But anyways, something to think very about, true. I think.
Yeah.
Political cults. Let's talk about that. So a political cult is a cult with a primary interest in political action and ideology. And groups which some have termed political cults mostly advocate extreme far left or far right agendas, oftentimes by violent means. Political cults have existed for centuries around the world with all different types of governments. And it's really scary that I think in modern America today, we're seeing these humongous shifts on the spectrum to being extreme left and extreme right. I think we saw that just this year with the Capitol riots. I think we saw some extremism at work right there. And, you know, yes, it's
I think anything that starts to bleed into people's values and morals, it becomes really divisive like that. And then can become, you know, more cult-like and exaggerated. And then we start to see the extremes on both sides. And then that's what's getting picked up, that we start to see more than people that maybe aren't as extreme. And then, like you were talking about earlier, that's kind of how these things form, right? As the people on the fringes, that's usually what turns into a cult, if it does.
I think it's interesting because anything, the middle seems to be vanishing today in a lot of ways. Politically, you know, you're not rocking the boat much. Everyone was in the middle. Things run smooth. Everyone seems to be pretty happy. When it gets way out there on those extremes is when freedom seems at jeopardy at sometimes. It's the same way with money. The middle's kind of gone. You're either kind of rich or you're kind of poor now. The middle is, whenever the middle's gone, you have these extreme divides between people. And then the world's rocky for a generation before it ever kind of levels itself out again. So it's very, very interesting. But we won't really cover political cults in cult following, but I did want people to know what they are.
Right.
The next cult is a polygamous cult. And these are cults that teach and practice polygamy, which is marriage between more than two people. And it's been estimated that there are around 50,000 members of polygamous cults in North America alone. So this kind of thing is going on.
It is. And often polygamous cults are viewed kind of negatively by both legal authorities and by society. And this view sometimes includes negative perceptions of related mainstream religious denominations because of their possible links or perceived links to, you know, potentially domestic violence and child abuse. And so, you know, I think that we've seen that. I'm trying to think of that HBO show that Bill Paxton was in.
Yeah.
Right. Do you remember the name of that?
Yeah. What was that called? I didn't list that one in the list of stuff, but I remember what you're talking about. Yeah, because he had like five wives in that, right?
Yes, he did. And that was kind of like you know, polygamy on the fringes, the more extreme aspects of that, and what went into that. And even though it was fictional, I think a lot of it was based on things that actually happened.
That's a like extreme Latter-day Saints stuff, right? Wasn't that what he was part of in that? Yeah.
Yes.
And in the Mormons, you know, the Church of Latter-day Saints, they have extreme, like, not only is Church of Latter-day Saints often viewed differently anyways, which we won't get into too much right now, but there are extremes within that religion too. And this is where this starts to come in. But this also has happened with a lot of other time frames too. Like, this even happened with like the Branch Davidians with David Koresh and in Waco. You know, there were a lot of people that said that David Koresh had multiple wives, that he had child brides, and that there was, you know, there was child abuse and sex slavery and a lot of stuff. I'm not sure how much of that was all proven in the end, but there was a lot of talk about that.
So yeah, it does seem like there's a lot of overlap between, you know, these different cults and what we see in the media as far as these destructive cults that we'll be talking about a lot.
We've kind of described the main classifications of cults for people, but we really haven't gotten too far into really what sets the cult apart. So we should discuss what happens when the leader is bigger than the doctrine. And I believe personally, this is when the cult becomes the cult, because, okay, let's adhere to the Old Testament, let's adhere to the New Testament, let's adhere to the Book of Mormon, whatever, it's fine. The doctrine's there. Even in Nexium, it's there. It's in pamphlet form, book form. It's taught to you. You're learning something. This is all good. For me to say this is a cult is like me saying going to a university is a cult because they teach you things in a certain way, right? So I don't think it would be fair to say that. Even with things that are really extreme, like Urantia and stuff like this, which are like UFO worshiping cults, I still think it still goes back to the doctrine. You know, if no one's breaking laws, nothing's happening, let's go with it. If you want to believe that UFOs are a religion and this is your view, then fine, let's do it. You know, there's people that follow the Harry Potter world and live it every day. Like, that's what they do, you know? So like,
yeah, I
can't, I can't criticize that necessarily, but what happens is when the leader becomes the thing, I think this is really the root of what makes the cult. So I want to ask you, you know, let's define the personality types of cult leaders, because I think the cult leaders are just as important. And one more thing I'll say before you answer that is, like, there are people that go to church every Sunday, but they never necessarily see their priest as bigger than what they're learning. But somehow this happens in these cults. So I've talked to many, many charismatic religious leaders, Baptists, Christian, whatever they are, whatever priest they are, whatever minister they are. I've met really interesting charismatic people that I think are great. And we see these people that lead the mega churches. I'm from Indiana. You're from Kentucky originally. Like we saw in the Bible Belt what this is like. We've seen these mega churches function in our growing up, you know, and
yes.
And there are people that are certainly charismatic leaders that lead these, and they have 30,000 people in their auditoriums locally, and then they have 100,000 or 250,000 more that are looking at it online. But it's still about the doctrine. They're still there for what they're learning, what they're reading, the message that they're getting. And I think that's important. And none of these people have really achieved that cult leader image. But yet this is happening with these others, these ones that have gotten in trouble. So tell me, what is it about these guys that's making them be these impressive, charismatic leaders? What's getting the attention of the followers?
Yeah, I think this is really important to go over. I know we're throwing out a lot of very kind of concrete information in this episode too, but this really is important to lay the groundwork for when we discuss specific cults moving forward. So, and I think you make a really good point about, you know, that these leaders that almost become bigger than what they're talking about and the doctrine that they're talking about is what tips the scales more to this side of the cult, of a cult. And so when I think about leaders in cults, I really think about a few different psychological disorders that we will discuss really briefly here and kind of talk about, discuss together. So we really think about these kind of megalomaniac leaders, right? So a person who's really obsessed with their own power, maybe it doesn't start out that way, but it really oftentimes turns into that, especially with these destructive cults. One of the most common personality disorders that we at least see traits of, if not a full-blown personality disorder, is a narcissistic personality disorder. And so discussing this and a couple of other personality disorders that seem to go along with these cult leaders, these really charismatic individuals, I'm just going to talk about straight out of the DSM-5. So that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And that's what we use in the mental health field to actually diagnose people. But just so everybody has a good idea of what this looks like clinically. So this is really narcissistic personality disorder. When we're talking about that, is really a pervasive pattern of grandiosity. So this can be either in a fantasy or actually external behavior. So internal world and external world. These people really need admiration. They lack empathy. And we often see this as beginning by early adulthood, maybe even sometimes in late adolescence, and it's present in a variety of contexts, right? So this is interfering with the way that they interact with other people, work, school, and also their internal world and how they're viewing the world based on how they think and are viewing things as well. So these people often have this grandiose sense of self-importance. They might exaggerate their achievements or talents. They might expect to be recognized as being superior without actually being able to like show the receipts, as we would say now, right? So you can't actually show any proof to back up these achievements, but you want to be recognized as superior regardless. They might be preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, brilliance, beauty, even ideal love. They believe they're special or unique. They can only be understood by other special people. They have a sense of entitlement that we often see, favorable treatment or automatic compliance with their expectations is really expected. And then they are often interpersonally exploitative. So they might take advantage of other people. Doesn't really matter. They don't care, right? Because they don't have a lot of empathy for other people, or they don't have any empathy for other people. So they're really just often what we think about as being very opportunistic, right? They, as long as what their goal is going to be met, that's what they're most worried about. And then we start to see this insecurity that really lies underneath all these grandiose behaviors, right? So they might be envious of other people or become defensive as well when people start to question all of these things that they're touting as aspects of themselves or their achievements that they can't necessarily back up. So do you have any thoughts on that, Todd, or how you would see that fitting in with these cult leaders?
Well, I have a couple questions, actually. I think one of the things I would like to know is, at least for me, and I think I probably speak for a lot of people that are just, average member of the public that don't understand the terminology you're used to working with. I've always heard the terms, psychopath and sociopath. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned megalomaniac earlier, which I was familiar. And then, there's the paranoid schizophrenia, all these things. Like, I don't know what terms are actually in use today and what's extinct as a term. Maybe you could kind of go over that a little bit and tell me, is narcissist the new way of describing all that? Like, is that what it is? Or how off am I when I use those other terms?
Yeah, so that's a really, really good question. And I think you're right. I think a lot of people don't know. And we throw these terms around, just in day-to-day language a lot of times, talking about sociopathy or psychopathy, and don't really necessarily know whether or not they're actual clinical disorders or included in the DSM. So that's an important question to go over. So sociopathy and psychopathy are not currently listed as diagnosable in the DSM. They have included some aspects of psychopathy in the Section 3 of the DSM, where we're really looking at possibly a new way of diagnosing individuals with personality disorders. But I won't go too much into that because we'll get too off track. But so when we think about sociopathy and psychopathy, I'll talk about those a little bit. And then I'll talk about the current term that really captures a lot of what people are thinking about and what the diagnosis would be clinically as far as it stands right now. So when people talk about sociopathy, we're really talking about this defining feature of individuals who are violating social norms. And with psychopathy, this was a term that was actually coined by Robert Hare, who also came up with the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, which is an assessment, a psychological assessment that is still in use today, actually. But psychopathy is sometimes considered similar or synonymous with sociopathy. So it's really a personality disorder, right? This is characterized by persistent antisocial behavior, impaired empathy and remorse, bold, disinhibited and egotistical traits. And then they might have oftentimes people that are psychopaths are really slick, right? They have glib, fluent, insincere and shallow speech, or the way that they interact with other people is very shallow, but slick. So very charismatic. So it's kind of a combination. When we think of psychopathy or sociopathy, I think of it as being a combination of narcissistic personality disorder and another personality disorder that's called antisocial personality disorder. So antisocial personality disorder is really this pervasive pattern or disregard for the violation of the rights of others. So this usually, it has to have been occurring since someone was at least 15 years old. And then they would also have a number of these other behaviors. So they have a failure to conform to social norms. So this is with respect to lawful behaviors, right? This isn't just like, well, I want to dress in a strange, unique way, and so I'm going to do that, right? This is more like I might be repeatedly doing things that could get me arrested, right? Stealing, arson, physical assault, that kind of thing, just as an example. They often have issues with lying, being deceitful. They might use aliases, conning other people for profit or even just for their own pleasure, even if they're not getting anything else out of it. Sometimes it's really just to kind of appease their own need to get one over on other people, so to speak. They may be really impulsive, not plan ahead. They're not really thinking about the consequences of these actions, right? Because they don't, as long as it benefits them, they don't really care if there are consequences to other people or things. They're often irritable or aggressive, might get into a lot of fights or being engaged with assaults, you know, verbally or physically. There's just kind of this reckless disregard for the safety of themselves and other people. They have a hard time being consistent with work or honoring financial obligations. And then one of the bigger things is this lack of remorse. They might be indifferent to, or they might rationalize when they've hurt people, mistreated people, stolen from other people, for example, that kind of thing. So when we talk about psychopathy, we really think about antisocial personality disorder, and then also really some aspects of narcissistic personality disorder as well.
I'm curious about the narcissist. So I guess what I'm wondering is the narcissist created by their environment? Is this a core of that person's being from the beginning? I know you mentioned when it comes on, you know, this can start coming on when you're in high school and whatnot. Is this something that the people around them are creating, or are the people creating the monster, or is this a feeling that they have from earlier on of what they deserve? What do you think it is? Is there a root to this, or I hope you understand what I'm asking.
Yes, I do. And I think that's a good question. And I think it's really important, or at least interesting, definitely, to talk about in discussion with cults. And I think we'll keep coming back to this question throughout these podcast episodes as we go forward, because as far as we think of it clinically, we think about two major things, right? Nature versus nurture. Most people have heard of that. And we really do think about how is the environment impacting us, and how is biology impacting us? So is there somebody in our family that maybe has these traits already? And so we've already kind of, we're already set up, and there's a predisposition to, for these things to potentially be expressed. And then they may or may not be expressed depending on how our environment is structured around us, right? Are we growing up in a healthy environment, or are we growing up in an environment that is unhealthy, destructive, unstable? Even sometimes it can be as simple as being a bad match in personality or sensitivity between a person and their caregivers that leads to the expression of these traits. And then they become problematic and maladaptive in nature. And then that's where we start to see the development of this personality disorder, right? A lot of times it's people as children or adolescents reacting to things in their environment who may already have this predisposition. And they're really just trying to adapt to what they've been set up with biologically and in their environment. And so I would say a lot of times you would at least see some of these things early on. But what are your thoughts about how that develops in the cult world?
So the reason why I wanted to ask that question was I was particularly how a cult leader is made, how they're built, because I can't help but wonder, like in the case of Nexium, which we keep going back to because it's one of the most current things out there. Keith Raniere. So Keith had issues in the past with doing illegal things and having kind of multi-level marketing companies. And he had done some unscrupulous stuff before he started Nexium. But I can't help but wonder when things changed for him running Nexium, you know, because at first I'm sure they had, if you watch the documentary, they had small rooms with a dozen people. They were very intimate little gatherings. People were learning the stuff they wanted. They were telling their friends, and this thing grew, right? Mm-hmm. They got a lot of members. And then when they had more members, they had more people that wanted to volunteer, more people volunteered. There were more little departments that happened under Nexium, which is where actually the DOS group, which was the whole sex slave portion, evolved from. Like that evolved from a little tiny private group, secret group within Nexium that Keith may or may not have even known about that had started, but it was definitely mm-hmm. there to service him. And we'll get into all these details when we do the episode on Nexium. But look, you have more members, you have more money coming in, you're getting press, you know, celebrities are taking your courses. Is this making Keith into a narcissist? Is the environment he's in creating it? He couldn't be creating himself to be a narcissist. It seems to me that all of this is feeding that. Does this make sense?
Yeah. So I think as a psychologist, my perspective would be, I would venture to guess that he probably had at least some of these traits, even if he couldn't necessarily be diagnosed with some of the things that we've talked about. I would guess that he probably had some of these traits that were already present in his personality and the way that he interacted with the world and other people. And then as this cult, as Nexium became bigger and bigger, I would say that he almost created this environment for himself that fed into those traits and maybe made them a little bit worse, right? Because usually what happens is these things are maladaptive, because when these people interact with other people in their lives or they try to go to work, they end up having some kind of a major issue that makes it really hard for them to function. And that's when it becomes a problem. And that's when they feel like they need to change something. But if you're able to create your own environment that really supports these things and may even make them worse or become bigger, right? I think it could definitely get worse and feed into that and become something much more intense than it would have otherwise. So I agree. I think there's definitely, it's interesting, but I think this environmental impact, especially for when we're talking about cults and cult leaders in particular, is very important and really feeds into how these people interact with others. And if they have these psychological disorders or mental health issues, that they've created this environment that kind of buffers against any reason for them to need to change and can kind of create this monster.
It's interesting you look at it that way. It kind of, you can't go to North Dakota to grow oranges, right?
Right.
So he's actually kind of cultivated this perfect air, perfect soil for what he wanted to grow inside of him, even if he didn't know it at the time. It's really fascinating to me. So I think we really touched on some important points on what could form a cult leader. I love that, everything that you said. So I guess with that, we're going to explore this deeper in the episodes to come as pertain to each cult and the cult leaders. But let's go to the other end of the spectrum right now, and let's talk about why someone would even join a cult. Do you think there's common identifying issues for followers?
I think so, at least from, so I mean, this is just probably a little more anecdotal, but based on the research that you and I have done and the things that we've discussed and watched, I would say it seems like there are some common things that people seem to be looking for. So maybe they're looking for some kind of support. So if this is support with other people, or maybe they're looking for some spiritual support, or even kind of questioning a religion that they might be in or spirituality that they've been following. And I've also noticed that a lot of times maybe these people have some history of trauma. Now, that's not always necessarily true. And trauma is on a big spectrum, right? So there are things that are less traumatic and then much more traumatic. And it all depends on the person and the individual. But that seems to be an underlying factor as well. And people are kind of sometimes maybe seeking out, ways to process that or work through that. And maybe they're not as comfortable going to a mental health professional or their church or their religious affiliation, or maybe they've done that and they're really looking for something else. So I'm kind of seeing that as far as a pattern, people really looking to work on themselves and then also building up a network of support as well. What are your thoughts as far as your own research and what you've seen?
Well, I think you're right on the money, and you touched on a lot of the things that I would have said, but I really think it's maybe three things. I think the first one might actually be sense of family more than anything. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of people that are single or maybe just couples that show up at some of these current new religious movements and cults. You seldom see a whole family. They're not bringing their kids, right? Like, there's something, obviously it's targeting a certain type person. And I think people like that family environment. It's that secret club. You're all brothers and sisters in this, So maybe you're looking, and this may stem from a deeper issue. And maybe they like the idea of the cult leader as a father figure in this too. I mean, that could also be the sense of family. I think the second most important thing would be just self-help techniques. People enroll in classes for things for self-help. And even if we were to push this toward 12-step programs, things like that, these are all self-help programs that you need to do to make yourself better. Executive success program, it was another way. People would enroll in that to be better speakers, deliver better in the business world, and then it evolved into something else. So I think those self-help techniques is why people enroll in these classes. And then I think maybe thirdly, even, is getting in touch with your spirituality or looking for something outside of the religion that you're, like you said, that it is simply a matter of God and spirituality, or maybe you're an atheist or an agnostic and you're moving toward this because you want to get a deeper sense of this. Sometimes it's even like the metaphysical. It's the idea of ghosts that spin you toward this. It's the idea of an out-of-body experience that you had that you're not really ready to dive into Christianity, but maybe this is going to answer some of those questions too. So I think those are like the big three for me. But I want to go into, why do you think there are so many men that are cult leaders? Like, we're going to get into some episodes this season where there are a couple of really dominant female cult leaders, particularly in Asia, but it's mostly men. Do you think there's a reason why men are cult leaders?
I think there are a number of reasons. So I would say, just at a base level, statistically, more men are diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. And there's been a debate actually in the world of psychology about whether or not some of the symptoms and the way that we describe these symptoms and even some diagnoses, whether or not they kind of skew more towards, masculinity or femininity, and whether or not there's kind of a bias as far as gender and diagnosis in those aspects as well. But I would also say, I think as far as society is concerned, we have this, we're set up in society that it's a patriarchal society, unfortunately, still. I think we're moving towards that being more even, but I think that because of that, we're already set up to see this power differential where men have had more power in society in general. And so that often leads into men being more likely and having an easier time setting up a cult following, so to speak, and even becoming a leader because it's easier to get into certain positions of power. That's kind of how I see it. Now, I think we're starting to see more women and feminine individuals that have a lot of these diagnoses or at least traits that we talked about earlier. When we are, I'm thinking about like Elizabeth Holmes and her, I can never remember the name of her, or her little diagnostic device, but I'm going to look it up just because I want to be able to remember it. Theranos. Yeah. So I don't know if anyone has seen that documentary, but she definitely has some traits of, you know, narcissistic personality disorder and maybe even psychopathy potentially.
Yeah. She's a fascinating one. Very interesting. I wish we could cover her, but she, you know, it's not quite a cult they created.
Not
there,
quite but, a cult. Know. Yeah, true. Something different, but it's just, that's something that pops into my head as far as people who are more in the media, at least a woman that has been in the media recently that has a lot of these same traits that we're talking about.
You usually hear the term narcissist thrown around with men, but there are women narcissists. We should clarify that, right?
There are. Yes. Yeah. Yes. There are women that have traits of narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial personality disorder, and the ways that we think of psychopathy as well. Definitely.
I think we're going to see, my prediction anyways, and we'll see, we'll revisit this in 5 years and see if my prediction is true, but I think we're going to see the first women cult leaders happening. I think it's happening right now, actually. And I think it just hasn't been, the term for the cult hasn't evolved yet for it, but there's a lot of things out there that are kind of on that new religious movement, the spiritual fringe, that I think there are some red flags for, like some of the stuff like A Course in Miracles. A lot of people follow A Course in Miracles, and it is considered a religion and a pseudoscience. And there's a lot of people that follow The Course in Miracles, Marianne Williamson being one of the primary practitioners of it. And this is a woman who was running for president, best-selling author. She's Oprah's spiritual advisor. Like, she is a very powerful woman. Also, if you ever, you know, go into researching her story, she actually was part of Unity Church, and she was a pastor at Unity Church and actually spun off her own version of that, her own kind of interfaith spiritual fellowship. She really was a creator of a new religious movement. So she's an enigmatic leader. People like her. She's attractive. She seems powerful. Like, she's really an interesting woman. And it poses the question to our listeners, would you consider her a cult leader, you know, even though she ran for president? Like, there's so much stuff surrounding her that really leads toward, this could be a woman who could run her own congregation and pretty much do what she wants with a set of doctrine in A Course of Miracles, which isn't really Christianity, you know? This is very interesting, right? That this, all the makings, all the ingredients are there. Mm-hmm. She's not, I'm going to specify, I'm not calling her a cult leader, but yeah, the ingredients could be there to make one, you know? And I think that's really interesting. And I see a lot of people like that, especially a lot of authors that are famous and their books are self-help. They're spiritual books. They show up in churches and they talk to their followers. And, you know, these authors are kind of like gods in a way, that you've come up with some new spiritual practice that really makes your problems go away. When Very does true. That start to fuel the makings of a cult, you know? So it's really interesting to me. And there's a, and actually right now, and, you know, from my, I have my own podcast called Quest, and I've interviewed a ton, a dozen kind of these new religious movements, spiritual leaders, and they're all kind of like copies of each other. You know, they're all, you know, blonde women in their early 30s. They all have around 20 to 30,000 followers. They offer certain types of classes, certain types of things, some things that you're normally seeing like yoga and then something else, or a breath class and something else. And they're all putting their ideology and their doctrine out there for people. And it's the it's an infancy of something, but they've got a lot of people relying on their word. It's not just that these 30,000 people are showing up for a yoga class every Friday morning. They're showing up for that and more. And I think these are the things that have the ingredients to make something bigger, you know?
Yeah.
So
very
it's really
true. And I just quickly, I wanted to also point out, I will also be interested to see, I know we're talking about women specifically even, but with the rise in social media in the last 5 to 10 years and where that is going to continue to go and how that will influence the development of cults and how often we see this and, you know, whether or not we see it more frequently. And whether or not we see more female cult leaders through social media and the influence of social media and these people that are becoming influencers now, even.
Well, it's funny because I would get a lot of feedback about why are there so many females that are these spiritual leaders that you have talking on your podcast, like your needle's pointing female more than it's pointing male. I can't find the males that are doing it. So I don't know where the males are at out there in the Instagram world that are doing the same type of thing, but I can't find them. So yeah. I definitely think there's a certain needle pointing a certain way. And I think age is also important to this. I think, you know, when you get out of your 20s and you're done drinking and partying and do all the stuff you're supposed to do in your 20s, you start actually thinking about other stuff in your 30s. You're thinking about marriage and kids and spirituality and where you're at in your life. And if you think about it, young males and even males into their 30s aren't really, the spirituality is like the last thing on their mind. Like that's not something that they're getting to until later in life, where women, there is this transition that's happening a lot quicker. And I think maybe that's part of the reason why I see more of that on social media. But certainly all these cult leaders that we've known through time, even if you talk about like Manson and his cult, or you talk about like the Nexium cult, you talk about Heaven's Gate, or any number, they're all pretty much older men that were doing this.
Yeah,
it's sometimes attractive, sometimes not attractive. There was a lot going on.
Interesting how that charm aspect doesn't solely rely on the attractiveness of the person. Right. I mean, a lot of it is how well they can speak to people, and that charismatic aspect has a lot to do with it. Even
more
so than
the attraction. We should have actually covered that more. We'll have to bring that up. We'll have to bring that up in another conversation, because we didn't really get into that. We were talking about what was going on in the brain with these people. Mm-hmm. We weren't really getting into their appearance and how they looked and what the attraction was to these people too. And I think we'll have to define that from cult to cult, because certainly, like what happened with Heaven's Gate, you know, it was a uniquely different story with really old cult leaders versus what you got with Charles Manson, or you got with Keith Raniere, or any number of other people. So, I mean, maybe we'll address that in each one. You know, was there an attractive appeal to this person? And I think in a lot of our interviews, it'll be interesting to have them say, there were a lot of people that had met Charles Manson that were like, that guy was like really charming. And then other people that said he was like the creepiest dude I ever met. Like, so it's like,
yeah,
what is the right answer there? Or is there one, you know?
Right. Yeah, I agree. I'm very excited to talk to some people and see what their take is on it once we start getting into some interviews and see what they say. And I would bet there's no right or wrong answer for sure, just like everything else in life, right? It probably falls in that gray area somewhere, but very interesting how it differs from person to person.
Well, certainly beauty is objective to people, you know, like everyone has most a different idea of what that is. Let's discuss one more thing about Colts before we start to wrap up here today. Let's discuss the multi-level marketing aspect of modern Colts. Is this important to Colts, do you think? How powerful is this as a tool to get people to join?
Yeah, this is really interesting. And I agree. I think this is really important to touch on quickly, at least before we finish up here. I really hadn't even thought about this and the relationship between multi-level marketing and modern cults until I started watching the documentary about Nixxiom and how that really started as this multi-level marketing approach to self-help in a lot of ways. You know, it ended up being financial and psychological and maybe even spiritual. And, you know, like you said, we'll talk about that when we get to that episode. But it's very, very interesting to me because I hadn't really thought about that before. There are a lot of, you know, issues that we could go into separately with multi-level marketing. And everybody has a lot of different opinions on that. But I think, you know, one of the things that we already touched on with this is it's a really good way to build this kind of support system and bring people in by, you know, you have this structured setup where there's a hierarchy already built in. On the surface, it looks like you're helping yourself spiritually, financially, psychologically, any of those ways or all of those ways. And the idea is to bring people in that you know. And so, you know, it's probably much more likely that you're going to believe somebody or even just try it out once or twice because your friend is asking you to do it or your family member is asking you to do it and you're comfortable with them. And everybody at least has usually one person in their life that they trust enough to, you know, if they said, hey, I'm doing this thing, it's really cool. It's like this new age idea about, you know, philosophy on life or, you know, mental health or whatever it may be. And you should come try it, you know, just come try it out. It's really interesting. You're much more likely to do that if your friend or somebody that you trust, a family member, asks you to do it than if, you know, somebody on the street or somebody just a stranger comes up and knocks on your door. Are you viewing it that way? Or what are your thoughts about the MLM Certainly. Aspect?
Well, you definitely see that in Nixxiom because it was built on a multi-level marketing platform because that was Keith's experience before that. One of the companies he got in trouble with was a multi-level marketing company. So you definitely mm-hmm. see this and it was definitely a core of his thinking. And you see it happen unfold in the documentary, like I imagine it happened on a normal civilian level, but you see it unfold in the show with like the actress Allison Mack. She is basically went to everyone in her Smallville TV show and was like, hey, come take this Nixxiom class. Like, this is really cool. And some of them were like, I can't afford it. Like, I can't spend $14,000 on this. And, you know, we're just making a little show in Canada. Like, I'm not making that much. But Allison was like really pushing it to people, to all her actor friends, which obviously was important because the more actors you get on, the bigger it's going to look that way. Because now big stars are doing it. So what normal person isn't going to do it when Superman's doing it, you know, like
that was kind of what I was thinking too. Yeah. Right. So especially if you can get some people that already, you know, have some clout in society or they have some positive publicity, they're on a TV show, even if it's small, right. People are thinking then you're probably more likely to even get people in there that don't know you, right? Because you have this really good way to market it with these actors or actresses. And, you know, in a lot of ways, we hold people in Hollywood and actors and actresses up on this pedestal, and we know nothing really about them except what their PR people put out.
Yeah. And that's been one of Scientology's big draws is that was the thing you joined if you were a celebrity. Like, mm-hmm. why wouldn't you go there? I mean, John Travolta and Tom Cruise and like all these big stars are in this. Like, how could this be wrong? Why would they steer me wrong? Like, they're doing this, I should come do this, you know?
It's so, almost like, I mean, it's a really smart way to market it, to be honest.
I think the other way too is, and this may not necessarily fall under the definition of multi-level marketing, but a lot of times you have to purchase the stuff you need for it. So you have to buy a collection of books, or you have to, you can't proceed to the next one until you buy the next one. Like that's part of this whole level of this multi-level marketing is, you know, you can get a discount on your books, which could be very costly if you get, you know, two more people to come in and buy at full price. Now you have a discount. Like, so there's all these levels too, because you have to purchase the stuff to move into the next class. And this isn't like a college textbook that's relatively low cost comparatively. Some of these books to move up the ladder or the bridge or whatever it is that they're going to call it, you know, could be $1,000 a book. Some of these class, and the more you get up higher in levels, since everything is built on ribbons and sashes and levels and numbers, since you have to now grow from level one to level eight, or, you know, yellow sash to black sash and everything in between, the classes are naturally going to get more costly the higher you go up, right?
So, yeah. And I think it's interesting too, like where just as humans, where, you know, these are levels that are kind of arbitrarily set up by whoever sets up these cults. But as humans, we like that, right? We like structure. We like feeling like rewards, we're moving to another level.
It meets the rewards-based part of the brain is what it's doing.
Yes.
You know, that's exactly what it's doing. And so you want to move up those levels, and your introductory class might only be $30. But then all of a sudden it's like, okay, now you're going to really enroll. You've gotten our preview class. Now you're really going to enroll. Now it's going to be $150 to take this class. And then, oh, well, now you're going to need to do this. And this one lasts 3 weeks and it costs this much. And that's how it starts to evolve in terms of the cost. So, so there, it certainly will get expensive, and that's all part of the multi-level marketing aspect of it too.
Yeah, good way to bring in money. It's also really interesting, and I think probably as we go through some of these specific cults, we'll probably dive deeper into this. But it's a good way to bring in people that are really high achieving and will really truly dedicate themselves to moving up in these ranks, and be committed to staying with this program, so to speak, right? So it's a good way to get some people indoctrinated that are really going to commit and stick with it for a long time. So you're not really having to worry about people coming in and out and not moving up.
I think that appeals to the competitive nature in people. Like if I enroll in a Taekwondo class and I'm a white belt just by default as the entry level belt, right? Like, if I don't like it and I don't get it, or I get hurt or whatever, I'm never going to take another one. Like, I'm done with Taekwondo, right? But if I like it, I don't want to just quit with yellow belt. I'm going for black belt. Like, that's what you do, is that you like it, you tried it, now I'm in it to get black belt, because no one wants to just stop at purple belt, you know? Like, what were you in Taekwondo in all those years, Todd? Well, I was a purple belt. What, who wants to be that?
Like,
you want to get to the top, right? You want to be in the inner circle of these things and get to the highest level you can. I mean, that's the point. So it's definitely feeds on that for sure.
And if you're somebody that's really seeking out, you know, admiration or support, then you want to get up to that highest level so that people can give you that recognition that you're possibly, you know, really desperately seeking. And it's interesting, especially in Nixium, we see a lot of people that are really high achieving. I think we should touch on that more as we talk about each individual cult, because each one brings a different thing.
Well, it's interesting too, because it actually breeds your next level of leadership, you know? So you get people that actually go through all the classes and learn all the stuff. And now you've just made four more teachers and your operation expands. And like we knew with Nixium, it was in multiple locations. They were popular in Mexico. They were popular in other places. And that's what you do. That's how you grow your new religious movement, your cult around the world. You have to have people to teach. Now, like Tony Robbins, if you see Tony Robbins in person, it's very expensive. You go in that auditorium, you know, you watch him do his thing, and it's a really costly ticket. You can take Zoom classes with him right now, but it's still about $1,500 for 30 minutes. Now, some people look at Tony Robbins as this great self-help guru. Some people look at him as a cult leader because people like live and thrive on what this man says. And the funny thing is this guy's been dogged by sexual harassment allegations and abuse allegations from his staff, from people around him. This guy can do no wrong. He keeps functioning. Like the Tony Robbins brand is still functioning and doing great. And it's, so it's really interesting how this works. That's very, I don't know if I want to spend, I don't know, as a psychologist, do you make $1,500 for 30 minutes? Because I don't know what he's getting.
No, but I wish I did. If someone would like to pay me $1,500, please reach out.
Dr. Katie, the money is in being a cult leader, not a psychologist, right?
I guess so.
Oh, well, man.
Yeah. But very interesting. I agree. And I'm just think very quickly. And, you know, again, this is all just opinion based, but I'm thinking about Rachel Hollis and her involvement with a lot of these multi-level marketing teams and retreats. And it's similar to Tony Robbins, right? This idea of toxic positivity that's recently been talked about. And I've kind of followed that a little bit, and watching that her branding, her personal brand fall apart as well, has been really interesting to watch and see her navigate. But there's definitely some overlap with these people that are involved in MLMs and self-help gurus and some aspects of cults and cult leaders.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I think we've mentioned to everyone up to this point, you should know by now if you're listening to this, but this is a limited series podcast because there's only so many things we can cover in modern history that we can actually have people on the show and talk to and interview. So I'm going to give everybody a hint. We don't know exactly how many episodes we're going to do yet. It's probably going to be around 12, maybe more, maybe a few under, but what we do have coming up, we're going to cover the Branch Davidians. We're going to cover Nexium. We're going to cover the Manson family. We're going to cover the People's Temple, which was Jonestown and the Jim Jones ministry, 12 tribes, realism, Heaven's Gate, and plenty more. So you'll see those coming up in the weeks to come. And I want to just kind of point out here something that I thought was really interesting to kind of help close the show out. In the United States, religious activities of cults are actually protected under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which prohibits governmental establishment of religion and protects freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly. However, no religious or cult members are granted any special immunity from criminal charges. So you can set whatever doctrine you want. You can dress people however you want. You can be as restrictive as you want. You could set up a whole no social media, no electronics policy, anything. All this stuff is legal for you to do within your cult. To say anything you want, talk about anything you want. It is all protected. That's what's interesting. But if you commit a crime, if you commit a crime within the cult, that's where there's going to be problems. And that's where you see sexual abuse come in and murder come in. A lot of things come in. But boy, I'll tell you, you can really, some of these cults you're going to find, you can go right up to the edge. There is a line somewhere. Yes. And sometimes you can even step over it in a cult. And you'd be surprised how much stuff you could actually get away with in a cult before. And you're like, why isn't that against the law? It's not. It's protected, you know?
Yeah, so very true.
That's what's really fascinating is that people call cults that four-letter word, but it's protected like anything else. So we're going to get into all of this. So as we close out here today, I think this has been a great episode zero for us. What do you think?
I think so. I think we did great. I hope that everybody else agrees. I know it was a lot of information and discussion, but I think it was, like you said at the beginning, very important to set this up. And this is really the foundation to what we're going to be working off of when we talk about these specific cults. So to have this information and to have listened to this is going to be important, I think, as we touch on these topics that we have talked about today a little more in depth when we talk about each specific cult. But yeah, I feel good.
Yeah. Great introduction for sure. Now people can find this podcast at anchor.fm/cult-following, and you can email us at jointhecultfollowing@gmail.com. And how can people find you out there, Dr. Katie?
So you can go to my website at drkatiesays.com, and that's just drkatiesays.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and any other social media avenues that we venture into as we continue this podcast, we will keep you updated on those too, and what those sites are.
Yeah, there will probably at least definitely be an Instagram page for this. And I think we were going to put videos up on YouTube and things like that. So we'll let you know as that stuff happens. And you can find me at metatomics.org or metatomics_Todd at Instagram, or metatomics on Instagram. So you can see more about the book that I wrote and the stuff that I cover and all that. So until next time, Dr. Katie, it's been fun.
All right. I will see you next time and we'll jump right in. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks. Good night, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for the International Association of Metatomics at metatomics.org, or find us on social media for other unique content.